And that was Chemistry with Can You Feel My Love? A very classic song that was sampled by a couple of future funk artists over the years. And before that was another song straight out of my middle school playlist, Betsy LaVette with I Can't Stop. The first time I heard that song, it was on a compilation, I think, and basically it just got me into funk and soul music. Oh man, so much nostalgia. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for me to go again. I hope you had a very good time for the last hour, and I will catch you next Saturday from 10 to 11 p.m. We're going to end our program tonight with another very special track, one of my favorites, Ordinary Joe by Terry Callier. Please rest well, have a very good rest of your weekend, and good night.
And for my opening line, I'm trying to indicate my state of mind. I turn you on, I tell you that I'm laughing just to keep from crying. Pretty music, when you hear it, keep on trying to get near it. A little rhythm for your spirit. Oh, but that's what it's for. Come on in, here's the door. And I've seen a sparrow get high and waste his time in the sky. He thinks it's easy to fly. He's just a little bit freer than I. Now here's a mystery, and maybe you can help to make it clear to me. When you're fast asleep, then what is it that's lighting up the dreams you see? All of your tears, I can't conceal it. And all of your prayers may not reveal it. You got soul so you can feel it. And when you make the scene, well, you know what I mean. Hey, I've seen a sparrow get high and waste his time in the sky. He thinks it's easy to fly. He's just a little bit freer than I. When you find folks are giving you the running round, keep your game up tight. And if you must, just take your secrets underground. Now politicians are trying to speak you. Mad color watchers are trying to teach you. Very few will really try to reach you. If you're lost in a stack, that's okay. To deny that I'm just an average guy. And don't you know each little bird in the sky is just a little bit freer than I. Hey, Ordinary Joe, although they say you're just a lazy so-and-so, what they think is real is nothing but an animated puppet show. So don't let time and space confuse you, and don't let name and form abuse you. When you think Joe Williams blues you, in the light of the sun you can see how they run. Oh, I've seen a sparrow get high and waste his time in the sky. And don't you know he thinks it's easy to fly? He's just a little bit freer than I.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Chris Hedges on the unfolding genocide in Gaza.
He's not only our greatest journalist, he's a moral philosopher. We also speak with journalist Patrick Martin on the hundreds and hundreds of billionaires that we now have in the United States.
This massive concentration of wealth affects every aspect of life in America. Our elections, our media, our education system.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. A week or so ago, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges entitled his Substack report, Israel's Trojan Horse. In the article, Hedges claims that the temporary pier being built on the Mediterranean coast of Gaza by the Biden administration is really not there to alleviate the famine, but to herd Palestinians onto ships and into permanent exile. And Hedges backs up his claim with his citation of statements from top-ranked Israeli officials, including its defense minister, that Israel's true goal in its current war in Gaza is the removal of these Palestinian people still remaining in Palestine once the current U.S.-backed Israeli genocide finally ends. As we know, the situation on the ground in Gaza is already catastrophic in the extreme. The Oxfam report of March 15 accuses Israel of actively hindering aid operations in Gaza in defiance of the orders of the International Court of Justice. It notes that 1.7 million Palestinians, some 75% of the Gaza population, are facing famine, and two-thirds of the hospitals and over 80% of all health clinics in Gaza are no longer operative. And it states that Israel's control of Gaza, and I quote, continues to be characterized by deliberate restrictive actions that have led to a severe and systemic dysfunctionality in the delivery of aid, close quote, end quote, that the Israeli state is using starvation as a weapon of war. And so today on Law and Disorder, we've invited Chris Hedges back to the show to discuss his article and other matters having to do with the Israeli-Palestinian war. Chris Hedges is, as I've already noted, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, having won the prize while working for the New York Times and covering terrorism. He worked for nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent for the Times, National Public Radio, and other news organizations. Hedges is the author of numerous books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Chris Hedges, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Before we get to the issue of the pier and why it's really being built and all of that, what was your reaction to the U.S. abstaining on the U.N. ceasefire resolution? Did the Biden administration, do you think, do that as much or more for political reasons at home as it did for any humanitarian reasons? I mean, after all, Biden is losing support among his base over his support for Israel. So what was behind that abstention?
Optics. It is politically damaging. It's globally damaging. And they know what, as horrific as everything is in Gaza, the use of starvation, mass starvation, as a weapon. Remember, there are thousands of trucks right over the border, a couple kilometers over the border in Egypt, in the Sinai, that the Israelis will not let in. They know what's coming. And I think it's a way to put some, attempt to put some distance between themselves and Israel, while at the same time cutting support for the UN agency, UNRWA, that distributes food and aid, on which at least 300,000, several hundred thousand Palestinians depend. It's going to be, of course, this genocide is being live-streamed, in essence. And I think the Biden administration, which is a full partner in the genocide, I think up to 68% now of munitions that are provided to Israel come from the United States, seeks essentially to try and keep, to the extent that they can, what's happening at arm's length, while at the same time providing the munitions and the logistical assistance to perpetuate the genocide.
Chris, all right, let's talk now about that pier, President Biden, of course, claims that his administration is building it, use it on the shores of Gaza, in an effort to get around Israel's barriers that prevent the sufficient humanitarian supplies, as you've talked about, getting into besieged Gaza over roadways. But you claim that the pier is not really being built for that humanitarian purpose, as I understand it, but rather to provide a way at some point to bring in ships and load them with Palestinians and, well, send them off to other countries in short to complete the job of the ethnically cleansing of Palestinians for that Israel has wanted and has pursued in various ways for a long, long time. Talk to us about that.
Well, we know the pier is not about delivering aid because the Biden administration has conceded the distribution of aid will be handled by the Israeli military. And the tactic that is now very plain after 6 months of this slaughter in Gaza is that starvation, along with, of course, the complete collapse of the medical system and the destruction of water purification plants. I mean, people are now 90%+ people do not have access to clean water, is the plan. And also, it's not a very feasible plan given the extent of aid that Palestinians in Gaza need. There's no infrastructure. There are no trucks. There are no drivers. There's no logistical system set up to even hand out the aid. And you know, the latest is that they have blocked all aid shipments to the northern part of Gaza, where roughly 300,000 Palestinians are now trapped. I think the thing we can say that is certain is that the pier is not to distribute aid. It's not even an efficient way to distribute aid. When you build a pier, things go in and things go out. And there have been reports in the Israeli press of the Israeli government attempting to court governments in Latin America and Africa to try and offer monetary incentives to take the Palestinians. Remember when the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, made his first trip after the October 7th incursion into Israel? He visited Arab capitals and had quotas of Palestinians that he wanted on behalf of Israel. These Arab states to accept as refugees. Well, I think it was 1.1 million in Egypt and 700,000 in Iraq, I don't remember, and Jordan and everywhere. Well, this was, of course, rejected on the part of the Arab governments. That doesn't mean that they won't take some. And there's a lot of pressure on the Egyptian government to take some Palestinians. We've seen the construction of a large containment area, far too large for trucks. I mean, nobody's buying that. The idea of putting Palestinians on ships has also been floated within the Israeli press very early on, by the way, several months ago. They did this in 1982 in Beirut when they evacuated Yasser Arafat and the PLO fighters. I think about 6,500 or 8,500, I can't remember, were sent to Tunis, and another few thousand were distributed throughout the Arab world. So I think it's clear, the intent is clear, and we can say that the pier is not about delivering humanitarian aid, and it leaves open this option that Israeli officials have already acknowledged, and that is trying to herd desperate Palestinians onto ships. Remember that the pier won't be finished for several weeks. And the UN is saying that now, within 3 or 4 weeks, there will be a famine, a crisis of within Gaza. And so the Israelis, which have already made Gaza, almost all of Gaza, unlivable, will offer the Palestinians a choice: death or being ethnically cleansed, being pushed out of their land. And when that catastrophic humanitarian crisis comes to fruition, the Israeli policy is designed to put pressure on the international community and perhaps even neighboring states like Israel to absorb these Palestinians.
In the meanwhile, Chris, isn't that also the case that the Biden administration's airdrop
of food. You see these planes flying over and dropping off bags of food and what have you. But has it any humanitarian value been shown from it? I mean, various international experts on the delivery of humanitarian aid have certainly claimed that this is a highly inefficient way to bring any real relief to the people of Gaza. And in fact, the airdrops, I think, have also been criticized, have they not, as being culturally blind in that they're sending down food that is religiously not food that the people eat, that they're supposedly helping. Talk to us about this aspect of the peer question and the humanitarian question and what's really behind what Biden is doing.
Well, it's a public relations stunt that is aimed at mollifying the anger on the Arab street. So remember, this has not just been done by the United States. It's done by Egypt. It's been done by Jordan. In fact, King Abdullah in Jordan was on one of the flights, and they published or put out a kind of slick video with music, heroic music of the king, on the C-130 or the transport plane dropping the. But it's ridiculous. I mean, it's also dangerous because when the chutes don't open, people have been killed. And then also, both with the Egyptian drop and with a recent drop, I think it was a U.S. drop, it lands in the sea and people swim out and they drown. So it's not only not efficient, but it's risky. But we have to remember that the Arab world, I mean, look at the demonstrations in Jordan, hundreds of thousands of people. They tried to storm the Israeli embassy the other day, and they are chanting, "We are all Hamas." And they were even chanting slogans against King Abdullah. So because Abdullah has colluded with Israel, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia, so the Yemenis have seriously disrupted the shipping that supplies Israel. And so a land corridor was opened up by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and finally in through Jordan to bring in consumer goods and vegetables and all sorts of other stuff. And this has really angered the Jordanians, 60% of whom roughly are of Palestinian descent. So the same is true in Egypt, I think throughout the Arab world. So what I think these airdrops are a way to, and they're given high publicity, a way or an attempt, I'm not sure they're working, to mollify public opinion, especially in the Arab world.
This is Attorney Michael Smith here at Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host Jim Lafferty. And we're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, in broader strokes, a couple of weeks ago, Oxfam issued a scathing report on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and indicated some of the reasons why that's the case. And then the International Court of Justice, the IJC, issued new orders pertaining to Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza. What's the significance of the Oxfam and the IJC findings and orders? Can you talk to us a bit about that Oxfam report and what it tells us about both the actions of the government of Israel, for that matter, the actions of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, the Oxfam report, and it's not the only report, has highlighted how catastrophic the situation is in Gaza. You know, you have 1.2 million, roughly, Palestinians who were told to go to the south by Israel. First, they went to Hani Yunis, then they were bombed in Hani Yunis, which was supposedly a safe area. Now they've been forced into Rafah. Rafah is not, unlike Hani Yunis, which is kind of a small city, Rafah is a village. And a lot of people are camped out in the open. Of course, there's no sewer system, so infectious diseases are rife. Starvation is now becoming rampant. That report was a good one, and it essentially was a kind of flashing red light to the international community that we are on the cusp of seeing wholesale death. I just want to say, in terms of the numbers, because it's roughly 31,000 or something from the Hamas government, from the Ministry of Health, has put out. No one that I know finds those numbers credible, not because they're too high, but because they're far, far, far too low. Those numbers only come from people who've been registered, the dead who've been registered at either morgues or hospitals. Well, virtually the hospital system and the morgue system doesn't exist. In fact, the numbers are catastrophically worse. I think in the tens of thousands, because of all the disappeared. And those people are under the rubble. And I think Hamas, which keeps its fighters protected in tunnels, has a vested interest, perhaps, in keeping those numbers low. And the Israeli government also has a vested interest in keeping those numbers low. But it's very plausible that we're talking already about tens of thousands of dead. And the Oxfam report said that within a matter of weeks, the numbers of people who will begin to die, not only from the aerial assaults, but also from disease and starvation, will leap tremendously. We're already talking about hundreds of people a day who are dying, but that number will explode. And that's what the UN and Oxfam and others have been beating the drums about now for the last couple of weeks with zero response. Last month, the Israelis actually cut humanitarian, which it comes in at a trickle and it's largely, again, symbolic. They cut the humanitarian aid into Gaza by 44%. So we know that this is clearly by design. We know what's coming, and that's what I thought the Oxfam report was very good, and that's what the Oxfam report was essentially warning the world about.
Yeah, Chris, one of the things we've talked about a bit, and it's, well, it's hard to find the most shocking aspect of all this, given how awful the situation is, but go back to the claim that is finding a lot of light of day now, that what Israel is really about here is not simply trying to get rid of Hamas, which it knows damn well it can't get fully rid of Hamas, that they're really using that initial attack, if you will, in the war on behalf of their really decades-long plan to finally purge all the Palestinian people from the historic lands of Palestine. You know, there's not going to be any, as far as they're concerned, any solution, be it one state or two, just a final solution. And that is rather shocking. It's been going on for a long time to people who haven't been paying much attention. The war has, frankly, brought it to light, which I guess you could say is one good aspect of the war. We have a better sense of what Israel has really been doing for all these decades. Talk to us about that.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a classic settler colonial state. It was built on the dispossession of Palestinian land with a large influx of Europeans and the British initially, certainly before World War II, were very supportive, the Balfour Declaration, supportive of this settler colonial project because they saw the immigration of European Jews to historic Palestine as a way, a kind of proxy force for them to maintain control. And this was true throughout the 1930s. And then with World War II, of course, Britain needed Arab allies, and the Zionists found shifted their patron from the British government to the American government, which has been a stalwart supporter of the apartheid state ever since. So in 1948, we had roughly 750,000 Palestinians ethnically cleansed, many of them pushed into Gaza. Then in 1967, the 1967 war, when Israel took the remaining 22% of land, that was the West Bank and Gaza, where Palestinians lived, that was another 350,000. So those were big dispossessions. But in between 48 and 67 and after 67, there's been what I would call a slow motion ethnic cleansing, a constant expansion of settlers, colonialists who have seized East Jerusalem, historically Palestinian, and huge sections of now I think up to 60% of the West Bank control the aquifers. So October 7th really gave the Israelis the excuse to do what they have long wanted to do, and that is essentially push all of the Palestinians out of Gaza, and if they can get away with it, they'll turn on the West Bank and do the same there. We see the violence in the West Bank has soared, and then we have also seen aggressive moves on the part of Israel to seize larger and larger segments of the West Bank. So, yeah, this has always been built into the Israeli project, and October 7th, in their eyes, gave them the cover to essentially carry this out.
Today's movement on behalf of the Palestinian people is worldwide. We've never seen anything like it. On the negative side, though, the war and the reaction to it risks bringing about an even wider war throughout the region of the world. But on the positive side, it may offer the Palestinian people the best chance they've had in 75 years of finally gaining some degree of sovereignty over their homeland. Which do you believe is more likely?
I take a very pessimistic view of what's coming, because unless the United States pulls the plug, the genocide will achieve its aims, certainly in Gaza. And I don't see the United States doing that. And then the question is, after Gaza, what next? Well, we know, again, intent. We know what the Israeli government would like to do. At the same time, I think Israel will not recover. I think that the kind of veneer of the pioneer state and, you know, the grit of the idea, all that's gone. And it will become much like South Africa, recognized as a brutal apartheid state. Remember, repression inside Israel, including against Israeli critics, is becoming fiercer and fiercer. But I'm very worried that without meaningful action on the part of the U.S., and I don't think that's going to happen with either the Republicans or the Democrats, Israel's going to get away with it.
Yeah, Chris, if I may, that's my concern, many people's concern as well. I'm wondering if there is any grain of hope in the fact that as the current presidential election progresses a bit, and Biden is finding it more and more difficult to sustain the notion that he can win, and if he continues to lose that base because that he has over what he's done and what his administration has done for the Israelis, if that might soften a lot or finally force him to take a posture whereby that support ends or becomes a trickle or is so reduced as to bring back those voters. Am I just being unduly hopeful there or seeing a grain of hope there, or is that unrealistic too, do you think?
Biden is a creature of the Israel lobby. He received more money from AIPAC, has received more money from AIPAC than any other senator, and he left the Senate to, of course, become the vice president. So he doesn't want to pay that price. He cannot have the Israel lobby also turn on him. And I think they're counting on the fact that, they have the heart of their campaign is fear of Trump. And I think they're counting on the fact that younger voters, Palestinian American voters, Arab American voters will grit their teeth and vote for him. I don't think it's going to work. But I don't see them. They do not want to alienate the Israel lobby, which has very deep pockets. You know, this billionaire Chaim Saban in California just held a big fundraiser for Biden. I think the figure was $42 million. I mean, it's very big. So he's not going to take on the Israel lobby.
Chris, we are sadly out of time. What are a few brief last thoughts, perhaps? And importantly as well, where can our listeners find your writings and learn more about your thinking on this matter?
My last thoughts are that what hope exists in the streets. The demonstrations on behalf of the Palestinians have 6 months now have not only been sustained, but the numbers have not dropped. And I find this the most encouraging. I look at genocide in the end not as a political issue, but a moral issue. I don't see how we can countenance genocide by voting for Biden. I don't want to see Trump win. But at this point, if these people don't begin to pay a price, then who else, what other people of color are going to get wiped out? And all of my work can be found on chrishedges.substack.com.
Well, I share your last thoughts, and I thank you for being here so much on Law and Disorder as always, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
There were 614 billionaires in America 4 years ago, before the pandemic. Now there are 737. Their total wealth is over $5 trillion. In the last 4 years, they went from having $2,947 billion to having $5,529 billion. That's with nine zeros. The golden rule in USA is that he who has the gold makes the rules. A corollary to this is follow the money. The immense concentration of wealth among a handful of billionaires in America has destroyed every institution in our country, from education to politics. What effects does it have on elections? We've got two parties. Both support capitalism, which has resulted in having two parties of big money. They make it nearly impossible to challenge their hegemony by forming a third party. The Supreme Court decision in Citizens United ruled that corporations are people. Thus, they can exercise their free speech rights and donate an unlimited amount of money to preserve and advance their perceived interests. In 1937, the great political journalist Ferdinand Lundberg analyzed wealth and class in the USA in his book, America's 60 Families. He wrote about how they functioned for the purpose of gaining and keeping political and economic power. In his 1968 book, Lundberg published The Rich and the Super Rich. It showed how the ruling elite controls the mainstream media and the U.S. economy and have virtually uncontested influence over American political institutions. The infamous names of the ruling class back then were Rockefeller, Ford, Vanderbilt, Mellon, DuPont, Guggenheim, Whitney, and Astor. They made their money in oil, steel, chemicals, that is to say, basic industry. But their wealth was relatively small compared to today's economic titans, who have made their money in tech industries and by speculation. So to talk to us today about the role of money in politics is Patrick Martin, a senior editor at the World Socialist website, where he covers politics in the USA. Patrick Martin, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick, you call the concentration of wealth in the USA staggering, and you've written that this wealth is in the hands of a tiny oligarchy. And why is that amount of money that they have so staggering?
Well, oligarchy is, of course, a historical term. It originates with the Greek super rich over a slave society, but it's used by analogy in the analysis of American society because we're dealing with wealth disparities that have no historical parallel, going back to Greece, to Rome, to the French Ancien Regime, to the slave South. I mean, there has never been a society as unequal as that of the United States today and of the world today. And that's why we call it, that's why I called it staggering.
Recently, Patrick, the Institute for Policy Studies, it did an analysis of billionaire wealth in the United States. So let's talk about that a bit. How many American billionaires are there now? And why has the number of billionaires grown so much as it has in the last 4 years? Did COVID play any role in that? Talk to us about this.
Well, the editorial that I wrote was based on the figures provided by the Institute for Policy Studies, but their figures are derived from Forbes. So this was not a radical group. This was an establishment group which is deeply embedded in capitalism, who produced these numbers. The number of billionaires, by their calculation, has risen from 614 to 737 over the past 4 years, up about 20%. Combined wealth has nearly doubled, up 88% over that period, from nearly $3 trillion to $5.5 trillion. This is associated in many ways with COVID. There are specific super billionaires like Jeff Bezos who have gained, obviously because of the heavy use of Amazon during the height of the pandemic when people were justifiably afraid to go to the grocery store or in general to go out. There are other billionaires whose wealth simply increased almost by osmosis or automatically. But this was related to a definite policy that was undertaken by both the Trump administration and the Democratic Party, which controlled the House of Representatives at that point. They enacted legislation that in March of 2020, which pumped trillions of dollars into the markets to, in response to what was called a freeze in the market for U.S. Treasuries, which is the most stable and important type of financial security in the world, the basis of the world financial system. And it was that decision which was the driving force of the increase in wealth for all the billionaires, and the fact that we're now on the brink of having the first trillionaire. It wasn't just an automatic process. It was a decision.
Patrick, let's talk about Jeff Bezos, who's the richest man in America, and Elon Musk, who's the second richest. What do these men own, and how did they make out during COVID?
Well, Bezos, as I said, his fortune is just shy of $200 billion. His wealth went up a little bit less proportionately than some of the other tech billionaires, but that is only because of his large divorce settlement with Mackenzie Scott. He had to part with $40 billion, and even for him, that made something of a dent. But his wealth went up by the vast expansion of Amazon as a delivery service, online order service, and also its close connections to the American military buildup, because it has contracts for much of the software cloud services that are used by the American government. So that was the driving force of his wealth. Elon Musk was much more erratic in his financial performance, perhaps in keeping with his personality. It shot up enormously at the beginning, driven by the value of the Tesla stock. It has now declined somewhat. He went up to first, and now he's back to second because of the EV boom has been somewhat cooling off. But he went and bought Twitter, as we know, transformed its name. He is a particularly striking example of the creation of wealth out of virtually nothing. The Tesla never made a profit. SpaceX has not made a profit. Of course, he bought Twitter. Much of his holdings and wealth is based in stock value that has appreciated, and it's the market that's driving that rather than any intrinsic gain in terms of profit.
Is it possible, really, for people to accumulate such wealth? I mean, these are figures I think you mentioned before that most of us can't get our mind around in terms of the number of zeros. I don't think it has to do with the fact they got up earlier in the morning than somebody else or worked later at night. It's got to be far beyond that. So what is it? Is it the U.S. tax code? Is it the fact that wages are still woefully low compared to profits and so forth? How do you accumulate that kind of wealth?
Well, it's those things play a role, and certainly in the case of someone like Bezos and Elon Musk, low wage exploitation of large numbers of workers in the case of Bezos is a major factor. I mean, 1.5 million workers employed by Amazon all over the world. And most of them are barely at the minimum wage in whatever country they're at, they live in. But I think the more fundamental question is the objective laws of the capitalist system itself. These have been not held in abeyance, but offset to some extent during the immediate post-World War II period. But they have been working themselves out with a vengeance over the last 40 years. The massive profit has increased steadily, and the actual real earnings of workers have been in decline throughout that whole period. The prediction made by Marx that the objective laws of capitalism over the long term would produce unparalleled wealth at the top and unparalleled suffering and deprivation at the bottom are being demonstrated. And that's what's happening now. It's not any individual's decision. It's certainly not any individual's talent and ability. Most of the people who made billions in the tech industry were not so much computer and software geniuses as people who were had business acumen, and they grabbed the opportunities, and in many cases they ran with them. And the people who actually did the technological innovations were taken for a ride. Once the profits are accumulated, they then have to, they are then divided up within the ruling class. And that's an entire, that's a very unequal process as well. And that, and you see that now. I mean, that's why you have, you know, hundreds of billionaires and the one or two approaching trillionaires. And even among the people who are in business, the vast majority of them are not anywhere like that.
The oligarchy has $3.5 trillion in combined assets. What does this look like in human terms, Patrick? For example, what would it take to cancel the student debt or end world hunger?
Well, canceling all student debt would, it's equivalent to three times, one-third of the combined assets. The combined assets of the, simply of the billionaires, and that doesn't include a large section of the financial oligarchy, that's $5.5 trillion. The total student debt is about $1.6, $1.7 trillion. So it's three times as large. The ending of global hunger, which is really one of the most horrible figures when you look at it, it's 150 times what would be required to end global hunger. In other words, ending global hunger would require a tax of about 0.8% on the wealth of the billionaires. 0.8%, not even a penny on the dollar. But of course, under capitalism, that's absolutely impossible. They won't give it up. It would set a bad precedent as far as they're concerned, because people might suggest that their wealth should be used for other equally legitimate social concerns.
Patrick, we know the role that money and big money and corporate money, oligarchical money, plays in our elections, and we're going to be talking a bit about that in a few minutes, I suspect. But how does the oligarchic character of American capitalism affect other institutions? I mean, the courts, the media. Talk to us a bit about that. I think people think, well, it plays an undue influence, and they recognize some places, elections, as I say. We'll discuss that in a bit, I suspect. But I don't know that they understand, or any of us really understand, the role that it also plays in things as simple as criminal justice or civil justice in the media. Talk to us about that, please.
Well, the American legal system is based upon two principles that are driven by that economic division. One of them is the sanctity of private property, and the second is the identification of corporations as people, as persons. So that in order, the presumption is that it's never been tested, but that a tax on wealth is unconstitutional, because you're taking the wealth of the billionaires or millionaires, whoever it is. There's never been an actual tax on wealth, as far as I know. It's a tax on income, but not on actual possessions. Under the American legal system, and this is probably true around the world, private property is inviolable. You can condemn it, but then you have to pay the equivalent on the market. On the question of corporations as people, this is, of course, political. From the standpoint of social reality, it's complete nonsense. Corporations aren't people. Corporations are associations for the pursuit of profit. But you have had, particularly over the last 20 years in the United States, a legal counter-revolution in which corporations are now asserted to have religious rights under the First Amendment, which is, of course, the right not to pay your health insurance if the owner of the corporation doesn't agree with abortion or contraception or some other medical procedure. Corporations are said to be people when it comes to something like Citizens United, where they can give as much money as any individual can give, and so on. The notion that corporations are people is a travesty, but that is something that is a consequence of the capitalist economic system in which we live. And then don't get me started on the media. I mean, the media, the corporate media, is controlled by giant corporations. All of the major television networks are owned by giant conglomerates. Many of the major newspapers are owned by either giant media companies or by individual billionaires. The most famous is Jeff Bezos owning the Washington Post. Another billionaire owns the Los Angeles Times. New York Times is a holdout only in the sense that the Sulzberger family, which owns it, is not a billionaire. It's only a multimillionaire. But Murdoch, who is many times a billionaire, he owns Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post. Of course, Mark Zuckerberg owns Facebook. Elon Musk has purchased Twitter. Google is controlled by two billionaire, multi-billionaires, and so on. You can name the people who control the media. It's not impersonal corporations.
Patrick, which billionaires support the Republicans and which support the Democrats?
Well, and then there's a third question, which is which support both. And the probability is that most of them support both. They invest in both sides. There are some well-known billionaires on the right. Besides Murdoch, there is Charles Koch, who with his late brother was the largest financial donor to the Republican Party. There are billionaires in Las Vegas like Steve Wynn. These billionaires support the Republican Party. There are more billionaires presently who support the Democratic Party. And I don't honestly have a list of them in front of me. In the last few elections, and this really begins at the end of Bill Clinton, but particularly with Obama, Wall Street money has flowed well over 50%. And by that, I'm including both stock market, hedge fund, banks, and so on, to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has become the principal party of Wall Street. And that's something that we've commented on frequently in the World Socialist website, which is the publication I write for.
Patrick, talk about electoral strategies a bit of the parties. You write about the money being raised in order to suppress third parties. How much money really have the two parties raised to keep third parties off the ballot or make it extremely hard for them to gain ballot status? You've got Bobby Kennedy Jr. running and others running. What is their strategy and what is the money issue involved in suppressing those efforts at third-party candidacies?
The Democratic Party has set up a special unit. It has several million dollars in funding to, as they put it, hold third parties accountable as though third parties were running wild in the United States. People are not aware, probably, that the United States, with its two-party system, is one of the most politically restricted countries in the world that calls itself a democracy. Instead of a one-party dictatorship, we have what amounts to a two-party dictatorship. The principal method that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party rely on, however, is not simply spending money. It's using their control of state legislatures, which actually set the ballot laws in the United States, to impose onerous restrictions on the ability of third parties to get on the ballot. And if you're not on the ballot, that makes it very difficult to compete. You get only can get write-in votes. if you look at the 50 states taken as a whole, they require well over 1 million signatures combined to place a presidential candidate on the ballot in all 50 states. I wouldn't make this comparison lightly, but the figure for Russia is 100,000 signatures, which is not to say that Russia is more democratic than the United States, but that on this particular yardstick, the United States is far worse. And there are states, for instance, California and Texas, whose requirements are more stringent than the requirements for the whole of Russia, which is not something to be proud about. The Socialist Equality Party, which publishes the World Socialist website, ran a candidate in 2020 who was unable to get on the ballot, even though we petitioned, we filed lawsuits pointing out that we were being required by the states to collect signatures under conditions of the pandemic when the state was forbidding people to get together. So it was, on the one hand, we were legally required to get the signatures, and on the other hand, people were legally required to stay away from us, and we from them. We lost those cases. We took one of them to the appeals court in Cincinnati, and they turned it down. There was one good consequence of that, however, and that is that in the course of these legal issues, the signature total that we were required to meet in Michigan, which is one of our main states, was cut from 30,000 to 12,000 because the judge looked at 30,000 and said, this is ridiculous, this is way too much, and he cut it. He gave the state the opportunity to pass it again, but they have not done so. This year, the Socialist Equality Party is running Jokey Shore for president. We have announced petitioning in a couple of states so far, but we will be prevented from getting on most state ballots, the majority of state ballots, because we don't have the type of financial resources that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does with his own multi-million-dollar fortune and his new multi-millionaire running mate. They can pay people to go out and collect the signatures in states where it's required to do so, which is, I think, 48 out of the 50 states require signatures to be collected. But this is a big deal for third parties. There's a handful of third parties, the Libertarians and the Greens, who are on the ballot in some states because in previous elections they won enough votes to get party status. And again, that's another aspect of the undemocratic ballot laws. You have to get in most states about 5% of the vote to retain your ballot status to the next year. This is not the situation in most European countries. You have dozens of parties running in different countries, and it does not prevent people from voting. It doesn't cause confusion. People know parties stand for different programs, and they look for the one whose program they agree with. But in the United States, you have really only two choices. No matter what you think about them, you're stuck. And that is the basic contradiction between professed democracy and the reality that confronts working people in this country. Both parties are controlled by big money. In this election, you have a choice between a fascist, Donald Trump, and a defender and an enabler of genocide and war in Biden and the Democrats.
Patrick, it's been great having you on Law and Disorder. How can our listeners follow your work, and particularly that article that you cited that we talked about?
Well, I write regularly for the World Socialist website, which is www.ws.org. It is the most widely read socialist publication in English in the world. And we publish 6 days a week. And I am the senior U.S. Editor on U.S. politics. We write regularly on struggles of the working class. We write regularly on culture and film And we write regularly on the broader international questions, such as the war in Ukraine, massacre in Gaza, and other developments that are taking place around the world. So that would be where you go. If you go to the site and search for my name as the author, you'll get that article. It'll come up.
Patrick Martin is the name, and boy, you've been a wonderful guest. We so appreciate you taking the time to join us today here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh.